It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back in the air with me tomorrow. Coming up on Central Time, low-income teenagers may face a digital divide, a lack of access to online technology that could affect their future in school and at work. First, President Obama is going to Congress for authorization for military action in Syria. This isn't the first time we've been here, so we called up historian Jonathan Pollack. He joins us from time to time to talk about what America's past tells us about our present. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, we were talking just before the news. The modern state affairs, when it comes to Congress, the president, and war, goes back to the Vietnam era. Let's start with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Talk us through, remind us what happened there.
Sure thing. So there had been small incursions by the U.S. abroad throughout the 20th century. There has been very small scale. And in 1964, President Lyndon Johnson went to the American people and said that American ships had been attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin in international waters off the coast of North Vietnam. By a vote of 98-2, the Senate authorized that Johnson pretty much had a free hand to commit American troops to fight that conflict. And the thought, at least as presented by Washington to the American public, was this would be very quick. This would be like earlier American incursions into Haiti and the Dominican Republic and other small spots around the globe. Obviously, the Vietnam War didn't turn out that way. And as the opposition to the war became more and more mainstream, in 1973, Congress passed what was called the War Powers Act, which spelled out more clearly the president's need to get authorization for significant commitment of U.S. forces from Congress. So since 1973, for the last 40 years, we've seen this kind of back and forth where Congress often kind of asserts itself, and if the president says that he's going to commit U.S. troops, Congress says, no, wait a minute, that needs to go through Congress first. In the case of this conflict, in the case of Syria, what I think is really fascinating is that there's certainly prominent voices in Congress who are upset at Obama for taking this step, who are saying that, no, the president has to act on this one alone. Congress shouldn't be a part of it. Which is kind of an abdication of a role that Congress has often taken on.
Well, others in Congress are saying, yes, do come to Congress. You have to.
Yeah, that it's I think another fascinating thing about this current conflict in just the recent context is that since about 2000, we've been in an era of unprecedented party unity. And that is that since 2000 and maybe even since the mid-1990s, if you're a Republican in Mississippi and you're a Republican in Wisconsin or Washington State, you all have the same thing. You've got the same ideas. And whereas earlier, for most of American history, there are huge differences among the parties, this particular issue is really kind of a throwback to how politics operated in Congress before the 21st century. It's something that is in otherwise is difficult for me to explain to my students about, that once upon a time, there were different flavors of Democrat and different flavors of Republican, and they broke down along urban and rural lines or liberal and conservative lines within each party. And this issue is really kind of cutting across party lines. Senators and congressmen opposed to or favoring the U.S. going into Syria come from a pretty diverse background.
Well, you gave us kind of the quick overview. I'd like to break down the steps a little bit. First of all, as we keep looking back at that 1964 Gulf of Tonkin resolution, as people reexamine the initial evidence, there was doubt and rightly so, I guess, about the justification for that resolution.
Well, yeah, a big part of the War Powers Act in 73 was the release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971, which revealed that actually the American ships weren't in international waters. They were within North Vietnamese waters. So they were kind of, you know, just a few dozen miles off the coast of North Vietnam. And therefore, the idea that North Vietnam would shoot at those ships is much more reasonable. They foresaw a threat to their port. And took steps to avoid that, as opposed to making an unprovoked attack out in the middle of the ocean. So I think that deception that went on, where intelligence in Washington knew one thing and Johnson, at that point in 1964 at least, successfully curved it past the American people, That got people justifiably mad. They said, wait a minute, our leaders for generations have been lying to us about this, and Congress needs a more thorough investigation.
So that initial resolution in 1964 had a lot of bipartisan support. How about the War Powers Resolution in 1973 reacting to what we had learned in the last 9 years? Was that a popular thing to do?
Yeah, the War Powers Act was also real popular because by 1973, again, the deception that kind of launched the U.S. involvement in Vietnam on a large scale was well known, and the war was pretty well indefensible. I mean, there wasn't much of a pro-war contingent anywhere in the U.S. Republicans and Democrats disagreed about how to get the U.S. out of the war, disagreed about the tactics used to end it. But given the choice, should we continue or should we end, pretty much everybody was in favor of ending the war. And that trickled over into bipartisan support for the War Powers Act, that there was a general dissatisfaction with the power of the president. And there was a fear that without the War Powers Act, a future president could act like Johnson and get the U.S. committed to a long-term, difficult war under flimsy pretenses.
Well, some people are listening right now and saying, finishing your sentence, comma, like Iraq. Was that another thing that did the War Powers Resolution come up there? Congress did back that war. Did that change anything?
Yeah, that's a good point. So in Iraq, President Bush was very clearly abided by the War Powers mm-hmm. Act and built up a great deal of support in Congress across partisan lines for his war in Iraq. And I think there have been some commentators on Syria who've talked about how in some ways the whole question of Congress debating whether or not to send missiles into Syria is kind of a charade. It kind of doesn't matter. And in some ways, I think Iraq is responsible for that. For that idea that even if Congress debates on it, there's not necessarily a guarantee that the administration's intelligence is necessarily perfect. As in the Iraq war, the U.S. is again depending on communications from exile groups, from groups who have left Syria, who could be wonderful and noble people, but also have a vested interest in toppling the present government. So there's some concern that even if Congress deliberates with the information they have, as in the case of Iraq, it could turn out that, oh, whoops, the information they were given was faulty and they came to this conclusion based on flawed evidence.
Two other hotspots for the War Powers Resolution since its passage, Ronald Reagan and Nicaragua in the 80s, and then Bill Clinton and Kosovo in the 1990s. Can you touch on the controversies there and how the War Powers Resolution played into it?
Yeah, sure thing. So in the case of Nicaragua, that's a case where the Congress voted decisively not to get involved in Nicaragua in a major way. But at the same time, Reagan was still able to kind of end run around the War Powers Act. That was the genesis of the Iran-Contra scandal that happened during the last couple years of his term. By channeling weapons to Iran, funneling the money into a fund for the Contras fighting to topple the Nicaraguan government, Reagan was able to accomplish some of his goals without Congress's approval and all in kind of a back channel sort of way. In the case of Kosovo, there also Clinton faced a great deal of opposition. Ultimately, Clinton was able to get NATO backing in Kosovo and was able to send, again, mostly air support and missiles in. I think in both of these, one of the ways that they attracted less controversy and less opposition than the Iraq war, especially in its later stages, or Vietnam, was the absence of troops on the ground, was that they didn't escalate to that point where there are large numbers of American soldiers going over and fighting on the ground. Clearly, Obama is hoping to do the same thing in Syria. He hasn't really talked about a major commitment of U.S. forces. He's talking about remote warfare and so forth. But you can never be sure of those things. War is very hard to predict the eventual outcome.
Big picture, talking about Syria and beyond, we had this War Powers Act in 1973 intended to resolve the role of Congress and the president in war. It's still a gray area if you talk to either side of that.
It's definitely a gray area. I mean, the War Powers Act is one example of many in the transition to what political scientists and historians call the imperial presidency. And that is the idea of a separation of powers where Congress makes these deliberations and then the president acts on it and so forth is fine in the abstract. But in the reality of the personalities who get into politics, the president wants to be able to act. The president wants to do stuff and is often going to chafe at Congress. Congress is going to assert its authority and the president will assert his authority and will try to find other ways within the executive branch to achieve his goals. The struggle over the War Powers Act is just one of many examples of the give and take between the presidency and Congress.
John, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That was Jonathan Pollack, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. He joins us from time to time to put today's news in historical context. Coming up, low-income teens are having trouble applying for college, applying for jobs because of a lack of online access and related technical skills. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time. One in five households in the U.S. still goes without access to the internet, but our next guest suggests the digital divide is more complicated than that. Oftentimes, low-income teenagers only access the internet through smartphones. That's handy, but it doesn't necessarily help them with standard computers, a liability in the workplace. Jessica Goodman is with us. She's a freelance journalist. Her recent article for Mashable is called "The Digital Divide is Still Leaving Americans Behind." Jessica, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you looked at a public school in Newark, New Jersey, but I'm guessing this story is probably true in a lot of areas around the country. But how did the students you looked at access the internet?
A lot of the students that I spoke with were able to access the internet only through their smartphone, whether it was a Galaxy or an Android or an iPhone, and that was only in very specific cases. Most of these students were only able to access it when they were around available Wi-Fi. That might be a hotspot at McDonald's, and at some point that meant that they were spending all day at McDonald's. And in the case of the students that I spoke with, they didn't have internet access at school. There was no Wi-Fi in their Newark public school. And so at some point, students would even turn their phones into hotspots and charge their peers money or bus tokens to have access to that Wi-Fi. So it made it really difficult for a lot of students to be connected in the way that most other teenagers who have, you know, home Wi-Fi are able to.
Well, I think people maybe of earlier generations like me might think, well, so what? I didn't have the internet as a kid when I was in school. How does that get in the way of them, first of all, doing their work in school?
Yeah, so a lot of the teachers that I spoke with who worked at this public school found it incredibly difficult to give assignments where research was involved, because now most of the research that students do is on the internet. And even when they did give research-based projects, a lot of their students hadn't grown up with computer or internet access readily available. So when they had access to school computers, they might do something like take the first paragraph they read off of Wikipedia and take it at face value, simply because they had not learned how to research the internet properly. And that was only when the internet was available. So a lot of teachers ended up giving your traditional reading and writing assignments where you might have to write an essay, using your hands, which is actually very uncommon nowadays. One teacher that I spoke with said that his students at the Newark Public School had less computer literacy skills than he had in 1999 when he was in high school, which is baffling in the age that we live in, where you walk around and pretty much everyone is ducked. You know, their heads are ducked and they're on their smartphone, or a lot of people who are just constantly connected to the internet, whether they're on a computer, a phone, or Google Glass. But for people who only have Wi-Fi access on a phone, it becomes increasingly difficult to keep up with the internet age.
Well, and even something that a lot of people now might take for granted, like typing a paper on a Word document, you could do it on a phone, I guess, but it would be very difficult, I imagine. I wouldn't want to try to do that. Are these students not getting some of those basic skills that a lot of people will need in college or the workplace?
Yeah, absolutely. Because a lot of these students didn't grow up with computers, doing something that might seem simple to somebody who had grown up with a laptop at home, it takes them twice or three times as long to finish a paper. One teacher said that she did have a student turn in a paper that was entirely written on her phone, and she forwarded me the paper, and you know, there are just tons of typos and grammatical errors that you might suspect to see in an email that was typed on a phone, you know, with the end where it says, "Send for my iPhone, sorry for all the errors." This was someone's high school paper that this is the only way that they were able to write a paper in their minds, I guess. And, you know, some of the professor or some of the teachers I spoke with said that they might give 10 or 15 extra credit points if you turned in your paper that was written on a computer. But a lot of times it just took them took the students so much longer to write a paper on a computer than it would by hand, because they might not know how to use Microsoft Word, or they might not know how to, you know, save a file or where to save it or where to find it once they saved it, because they didn't have the access or the ability to use a computer at home or to use a computer constantly at school. Whereas students who grow up, you know, in middle class or upper middle class families where computers are readily available, those skills are just innate to them and it becomes second nature. You know, Command S equals save and Command P equals print. A lot of students who don't have access to computers have no idea what that means.
And the phrase digital divide is in your headline, and that's the big issue, isn't it? That the kids you're looking at, the low-income kids, are starting 10 feet behind everybody else because they don't have those basic skills as they enter college or enter the workforce.
Absolutely. And when teachers try to, you know, help them in any way they can, a lot of teachers I spoke with expressed the feeling that it felt like putting a Band-Aid over a bullet hole, that there's just such a lag that comes from not using a computer every day of your life that it becomes really difficult to catch up to the rest of society, even in the workforce.
So what happens when the kids you're looking at there think about applying for college? Applying for college is a big pain in the butt anyway with the computer. How much higher of a hurdle is it if you don't have those skills coming out of high school?
I mean, it's just incredibly difficult because so many of the applications are online now. And if you want to apply online, if you don't have a computer, I mean, it's nearly impossible to apply to college on your smartphone. And so a lot of students will take the time to work in libraries. In New York City, the New York Public Library System is a place where many, many low-income students go to use the computers every day, and they often do use it to apply for jobs and apply for college. But without a computer, it just becomes incredibly difficult. And then even if you do get to college, how do you go about using computers in college when you've never really done that in high school? But more importantly than applying to college and filling out FAFSA forms are the students who opt not to go to college and try to enter the workforce immediately after high school. More than 80% of Fortune 500 companies now require online job applications. And even though that number doesn't seem very high, when you look at non-Fortune 500 companies, just small businesses in your cities, fast food joints, nearly all of them will tell you when you walk in to apply for a job, oh, just go to our website, you can fill out a job application there. And that's where, you know, it becomes just, like I keep saying, incredibly difficult.
So in the research that you did and the people you talked to, are there thoughts about what kind of solutions people are looking for and hopefully cost-effective ones?
Yeah, absolutely. Some experts that I spoke with said that America as a whole needs to look towards Europe and see what they're doing in order to get broadband internet readily available to almost everyone in the country. People keep saying that we need to look at the internet as a basic human right now. It's like what the telephone was in the early 20th century. It's just become such a necessity for everybody to have it. And without having basic broadband, by the government's definition, you're pretty much not a human. You're not able to keep up just with everything that's going on in the world. So a lot of people say that we need to have government regulation on the internet and destroy the monopolies kind of that have come up in certain cities of the internet providers and make it more financially feasible. And then there are also programs like Connect to Compete is one that offers low income, or it offers internet to low income families. But in order to get that, you have to there are a lot of restrictions in terms of how much money you make. And if you have children and if they qualify for reduced fare lunches, that's one of the requirements it takes to get your internet to about $10 a month, which is some of the lowest rates in the country for internet ever.
And then that broadband, just briefly, that broadband's just half the battle. In about 20, 25 seconds, how about getting computers in the hands of those people then?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the other part of this problem, is that there need to be just more readily available computers for Americans. There are netbooks that are you know, way cheaper than getting, you know, a MacBook Pro or something like that. But in order to get that, there just needs to be more computers available and more people making computers in order to get them in the hands of everybody.
Gotcha. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. That's Jessica Goodman, freelance journalist based in New York. Coming up tomorrow at Central Time, speaking of technology, we'll do a nostalgia segment with the continuing appeal of typewriters. And as it turns out, messy desks can actually help our creativity. That's good news for me. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a mobile recording studio, possibly in the works for Native Americans, part of an effort to boost creativity, creative outlets, and prevent suicide. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The suicide rate among Native Americans has grown quickly in the last decade, far ahead of any other group in the country. There have been a lot of proposals to try and bring that rate down, but it remains stubbornly high. Our next guest wants to try a new approach. He says a big step in reducing that suicide rate would be to provide more creative outlets for Native American youth and young adults. One way to do that, he wants to open a mobile recording studio for Native Americans to get their music recorded in a professional setting. He's looking for help to get the idea off the ground. Here to tell us about it is Elliot Christensen. He's a music business student at Globe University in Madison. Elliot, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, talk first of all about the suicide rate among Native Americans. You're giving me some numbers just before we started that are very sad.
Yes, the suicide rate is 3 times higher than any other demographic on reservations, than any other demographic in the United States. Some reservations see that go up to 16 times, and it's really became an epidemic, is what I'd like to say. It's a real big problem. It's almost like a state of emergency for a lot of these reservations.
And this is a personal issue for you, too.
Yes. I recently lost a cousin this fall. To this epidemic, and this is when this idea really started to come about.
And why a recording studio? Why is that the way you want to try to help make a dent in this?
Well, music seems to be a real art. It is for me. You listen to artists, they're artists. When their music comes out, it requires us, you know, some creativity. Mm-hmm. So I would like to let them express that creativity, and also to be able to give them some hope. You know, I was born on a reservation. I went out. You can go out too. There's hope. There's possibilities. There's a way for you to get yourself heard.
And music also, I mean, it's a way to express yourself and tell your story, whether you're literally, you know, saying your story in lyrics or doing it in musical form. Do you think that's part of why this idea seems exciting to you?
It is. It's a real way for them to express themselves, to get through those hard times or something like that. Write a song. Hey, record it. Send it to me. Whenever I get this up and running, I plan on being available and to have people that are available to read over people's songs and, hey, let's do this or think about that. And, you know, just to be there for them.
And you are a music engineer, and you're training in that right now at Globe University, right?
Correct.
And so your hope is, I think it was a mobile recording studio. How would this work? What would you do?
We looked at a couple different examples, like the John Lennon tour bus that they have that is set up with a recording studio. And I think that would be a great start, kind of have like a bus where they can see how the studio is set up, and then be able to record their music.
And you'd travel around the region, around the country?
I would plan to travel around the country. Like I said, this is an Indian country problem. This is on every reservation. It's not just one. So,
And when you have told other people, people who are on reservations about this idea, what do they think about it? What's been the response so far?
So far, it's been really positive. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback, and I've actually been able to recruit a bunch of help. I have video photographers and some other people and songwriters and singers that would like to travel with to be able to talk to the kids and be able to help them as well.
And maybe be a backup band or provide some backup vocals or something,
that
maybe?
That would be great.
Okay.
And, you know, to actually inspire these kids that say, you know, I'm an artist, I went to Austin, or I went out to L.A., or I'm singing gigs, and I'm just to be able to inspire them that, hey, you can make it too.
And the idea isn't that everybody you record is going to be a rock star.
No, it's not possible, but sure. They'll be able to get their voice out there and be able to get it heard.
Well, and also, I mean, getting it out there, but also I think sometimes just holding it in your hand, whatever form it may take, a CD or, you know, if you're old-fashioned like me, or some of the more newfangled technology, being able to hold that up and say, I did this.
Right, and be able to have it done in a professional studio to see how it's all done. Then they'll be able to take it and put it on a platform where, who knows, maybe somebody hears that song and wants to record that song. And, you know, that's what it's all about, is just getting their voice heard.
And so do you have a timeline on this? When are you hoping it gets up and running? Yeah, that's a tough one, yeah.
I am actually working on it. It's a work in progress. We're in the early stages right now. But as it gets going, I'm looking at really making a push for it in March, which is when I graduate. So,
okay. And now, what kind of music do you envision? I mean, people might hear this and think, oh, you're trying to get Native American traditional music. That's not it, though, right? Or that could be.
That's it's all up in the air. Whatever they want. If there's a drum group that comes in and wants to record something, I'm actually working on building a mic setup for a traditional drum so we can get a better recording. And if they want to do that, that's fine. If they want to come in and even do a cover of a song just to see it be recorded, we'll do that too.
And why, I mean, of course, the personal story and the statistics out there, why you, I guess, is what I'm asking. Why do you feel the need that you need to get out and do this?
My grandpa Chris, he passed away a couple years ago, Chris Leith, and his saying was always, what does your journey matter if you don't share it with others? I've been blessed enough to be able to come to school, and I want to share my journey with others. And if I can help some of these kids, that's a big plus for me.
And are you looking for helpers apart from the musicians you mentioned? Are you visioning yourself as kind of mostly a solo gig driving around the country, or are you looking for a team to do this?
No, I know that I'm not going to be able to do it all by myself. I'd like to think that I'd be able to, but I know I can't. I won't be able to do that. So I am going to be putting a team together to go out and be able to do this.
And that's one of the next steps. And what else is next for you between now and, fingers crossed, March to get this up and running?
I'm studying into Native American business grants, but I'm not the greatest writer. My problem is I like to keep everything kind of short. I don't give long explanations for stuff. But we're looking into that and starting to get some funding and some sponsorships. We're digging into that. That's kind of what I'd like to get set up by March.
And so if somebody's listening and saying, I know how to write grants, or, gosh, if you're in my area, I'd love to go and play bass with whoever you're recording, or wants to help out in any way, how can they get in touch with you?
Feathernotemusic@gmail.com is the email that we set up for this for right now, and that's the best way to really get a hold to be able to help with this project.
And as you're talking to people, we mentioned on reservations and off, are you getting a lot of gleam in the eye from people like saying, this is a good idea, we need to run with this?
Yes, I've had the ability to have some great instructors, and they always said, do what's going to make you happy, follow your dreams. And you know, going into the music business, I wasn't sure what I was going to do, if I was going to manage or what I want. I just know I wanted to be in that environment. But I was able to kind of find a niche, engineering and mixing and stuff like that. So that's what I wanted to do, and that's how it all kind of came about.
If we have you back on the show in a year from now, what would success look like? What would you at that point be saying, hey, we're doing good work here?
Having a crew up and being able to go to the reservations and being able to record these kids and interact with them. That's would be success for me in any capacity, if it's in a minivan or whatever, as long as we're able to get to those kids and help them.
And hopefully bring down that suicide rate one kid at a time, if that's what it takes.
One kid at a time. No matter what, if we're saving, if it touches one kid's life and gives them some hope, that's success for me.
All right. Elliot, say that email one more time for us, and we'll try to put it up on our Central Time Facebook page.
It's feathernotemusic@gmail.com.
All right, Elliot, I'm hoping that we can have you back on and play some tracks that you've recorded along the way. Elliot, thanks a lot for coming up here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That was Elliot Christensen. He's a music business student at Globe University in Madison. He's working on this recording project, trying to get a mobile studio to go to reservations around the country, give kids some hope, and cut down the suicide rate. Coming up next, we'll talk about bringing philosophy to the dinner table with the author of a new book on the subject. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of people host dinner parties with their friends, but our next guest says you can nourish your mind and your body with a philosophy dinner club. We're going to talk about philosophy this hour and how to bring it into our daily lives. How about you? Do you think about philosophy on a daily basis, or is it just maybe a class you took in college or a segment into high school that didn't seem like it applied to you? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you talk about philosophy? How do you define it? Call 800-642-1234 or email us, talk@wpr.org. Marietta McCarty is with us. Her new book is The Philosopher's Table, How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club, Monthly Conversation, Music, and Recipes. She taught philosophy at Piedmont Virginia Community College for 2 decades. Her other books include Little Big Minds, Sharing Philosophy with Kids, and How Philosophy Can Save Your Life. Marietta, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, sometimes when I think of philosophy, I'll be honest, it seems like it's a highfalutin brain exercise for the academics, but you've spent your career, I guess, making the case that philosophy is too important to leave to the philosophers. Why?
That's exactly right. I found in the study of philosophy how very practical and useful it was for me. And you were talking about how to define philosophy, and I define it as the art of clear thinking. It's emptying the mind of the clutter and the noise and the unfounded opinions and assumptions we may have, and making room for more clarity about ideas that are really essential to good living, gratitude, generosity, humility, whatever that may be, how to simplify our lives. And I think it's really unfortunate that I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say, oh, philosophy, I remember that course I took for a couple of months in college. And really, it is so useful. I think people really like to come together and have conversation and communicate in a genuine kind of way and think about the good life and what our priorities should be. And whether it's the children I've taken philosophy to, my college students, or the many diners and readers who keep in touch with me, they're finding that how much this is nourishing their lives to come together, learn about other cultures, and to talk about ideas that really matter. So in my book, I've chosen 12 topics and 12 places in the world so that dinner clubs can meet once a month and experience January in Japan, let's say, or we're in September in Kenya, and talk about a topic, talk about the culture, listen to some music from that culture, and then eat some food. And the world becomes much bigger and also in a way much more intimate.
Why food? Why is food such an important part of the equation here?
Well, discussion and conversation have always been a part of philosophizing for me. And solitude is great, reflection is key, but sometimes we discover things together that can't be delivered by solitude. And what brings people together better than food. I think that, we have the expression comfort food. Maybe all food is comfort food. The soothing atmosphere, the carafes being passed, the bread is breaking. And I think food is an icebreaker, and I think it's a relationship maker. I think that food is something happens when we come together and eat and pass the something at the table and take time to be together.
You've been doing these philosophy dinner clubs, right? You didn't just start this for the book. This is something that's part of your life, isn't it?
That's right.
And do your friends, are they suspicious when you invite them over for supper? Is the food just a bait, but they know, oh, she's going to bring up some philosophical issue and throw it at us?
Well, I've managed to work it that I'm usually the one that's invited to their
house.
So that's working really well for me. And what people are doing in my town, here in Charlottesville in Virginia, is they've started these dinner clubs, and many of them are ongoing. And what this book does is it sort of gives them permission to try recipes and things that they might not have made before. And the topics that I've chosen that I think are so important, they are topics that I think we should be able to talk about. Well, persistence and grace, for example, simple pleasures is another one, decision making. They're not necessarily political, or they're not religious. They're things that I think in my travels with philosophy are important to be talked about. So my friends aren't suspicious. They sort of know what's going to happen, and they're very eager for it. The book's only been out about a week, but in preparation in writing this book, Rob, I had people all over the country cooking and testing and tweaking the recipes and actually having the dinner parties with the particular topic in mind. And, the pure pleasure they derived from it was incredible. The stories that were told, the relationships that were formed. So it's just wonderful information coming back my way.
So let's talk through how a dinner night, a philosophy dinner night, might work. You mentioned September was a Kenyan theme. Is that right?
Yes.
So
yes.
If I'm a guest, do I have to do some homework before I show up?
Yes, you do.
Uh-oh.
But it's very pleasant. It's not homework as we think of it. So here's basically what we would have for that chapter. The topic is a fruitful ecological solution. And I turn to one of my favorite philosophers, Wangari Maathai, from Kenya. And so I talk about why this issue has proven important in my philosophy travels. The issues that are in the book are all weighing on people's minds. So we know that we have environmental issues both in our homes and in our local communities and globally. So I talk a bit about the issue. And then I have a section called Prepping for Kenya. So there are things that you can read. There are things that you could go online, for example, and check out the Masai Mara National Reserve. There are movies you can watch. The wonderful movie, The First Grader, directed by Justin Chadwick, which is a marvelous film to be introduced to Kenya. And then I introduce the reader to the philosopher, to Wangari Maathai, and her take on this issue and how she addressed Kenya's very dramatic, overwhelming ecological issues. And so that's what the homework would be, and what you know is what the dinner topic will be. So I give the topic, it's a quote from her, from Maathai, and sort of set up what the conversation might be like for dinner. And then philosophy dinner clubs almost always, in my experience, rotate who's hosting it, but there are lots of suggestions for what guests can bring. So you can bring boiled peanuts, let's say, or grilled plantains, or Maathai loved figs. And so there are suggestions for what the guests bring, and then also music. And a lot of people like to listen to the music to get into the mood before the dinner. And then the recipes that the host would provide. And for Kenya, it's squash and apple soup. Both squash and apples are so important in that particular culture. And so people can learn about where the food is coming from and shop for it and that sort of thing. And then one of the most popular recipes in the book is No Need African Seed Bread. And that's the other thing that the host would fix. And then at the end, Rob, there's Kenya to go, and there are more things that you might want to read, more things to listen to, some more music perhaps. Maasai often referred to herself as a hummingbird, and so there's a movie that you can look at that explains why. She said the hummingbird just does the best it can. That's all any of us can do, is the best we can when it comes to the environment. And then it finishes with the resources that were used in that chapter. So it does require a commitment of time on the part of the diners that they are going to read about the topic. They're going to think about it. They're going to make the appetizers, pick up the appetizers, and participate and give it their full attention. I think that's universally what I'm hearing from around the country, is that when you do make this commitment that once a month we're going to do this and it's going to matter and we're going to learn from each other, that's the trick, is making the commitment of time.
How do you pick that guest list of people who are you're going to ask to make that commitment?
Well, what people are doing, a variety of things. Some people are mixing it up and say maybe a couple of family members, a neighbor or two, a couple of colleagues. Some people are inviting, the recipes serve eight, and some people are choosing four people, three people, something like that, and then they pick somebody. So it's people who didn't know each other before. So there are a lot of different ways to go about choosing who you might want to have, and the important thing is to make sure that they are looking for this good conversation and will make the commitment of time.
So you sit people down. They're not philosophers. In your experience, how long does it take before that conversation really gets rolling?
Well, if I've done my job, it shouldn't take very long, because in talking about the issue, whatever that may be, say persistence and grace, I explain why it's an issue, write about it in a way that should help people talk about it. And I think that, you know, if philosophy is the art of clear thinking, then I think we all have the potential to philosophize. I remember I was giving a talk once, and there were some child philosophers there. They were in the third grade, and they did philosophy three times a week at their school. And so I was speaking to an adult audience, but they were there. So I asked the children, I said, do you have anything you'd like to say to the group? And one child said, yes, I would like to say, don't feel that you can't do philosophy just because you're a grown-up. So children do philosophy. They're natural philosophers. We all have the ability to think and reflect. I think we're starved for good conversation. The world's very noisy, and we're moving really fast. And to sit down and spend time together, I think, fulfills a real, it's soul food, and I think that's what we're hungry for.
Are kids ever part of these?
Well, not, I mean, everywhere I go, pretty much, you know, whether it's a picnic with children or whatever, usually there's some food involved with them. I think it's possible for children to be involved, although I wasn't thinking about including them when I was writing the book, but I don't think it's out of the question at all.
We're continuing our discussion about the Philosopher's Table after we take a look at the news, and we'll take your calls. Do you feel like philosophy is a part of your daily life? Do you wish it were more so? And do you like this idea? Do you think you want to try this and ask for some advice? Getting people together for a philosopher's dinner, a philosophy supper. Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Send an email, talk@WPR.org. or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Marietta McCarty is with us. Her book is The Philosopher's Table, How to Start Your Philosophy Dinner Club, and we'll pick that up in just a little bit. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.